Yay.
Good, bad, or complicated.
There's no news in Ottawa and the Valley he won't talk about.
It's Wake Up with Rob Snow on City News 101.1.
The Ottawa Senators are back in action tonight, actually, on home ice. Vegas Golden Knights in town. That's a 7 o'clock faceoff. But all the news is coming off the ice with the sale of the Ottawa Senators, a real possibility. We're joined now by Moishe Lander. He is a professor of economics at Concordia University, and I call him the sports economist. He looks at the economics of professional sports. He joins us this morning on City News. Good morning, Professor. Welcome back.
Good morning. You know, it's been 2.5 years since we spoke. We spoke when COVID started and shut down professional sports. So I guess there's been no sports news in the last 2.5 years. That must be it, right?
Well, no, it is great to have you back, Professor. This is very big news, as you can imagine, the potential sale of the Ottawa Senators following the passing some 7 months ago of Eugene Melnyk. I want to begin by asking you, just how rare is it that a professional sports franchise goes up for sale?
It is rare. There's 124 professional sports teams in the Big Four in North America, right? Hockey, basketball, baseball, football. If you have one of them that comes up for sale every few years, that's a 1% turnover. So it's very, very rare. It's very, very small amount. And so it is big news.
The Ottawa Senators, at least according to one published report, have a valuation of $665 million U.S. I'm wondering, when it comes to placing a dollar value on a sports franchise, what sorts of things are part of that calculation?
Well, one thing is looking for comparables. Like you said, it doesn't happen very often, but franchises do go up for sale. And so it's kind of similar to the housing market, right? How do you know what your house is really worth? It's usually the comparables. You look for other houses that have similar characteristics to yours. And so if you want to try and put a valuation on the Senators, you would take a look at, say, the Pittsburgh Penguins were sold recently to the Fenway Group, and they were valued somewhere around the same price as the Sens. And given that they have a comparable market, roughly a comparable geography, this would be maybe the comparable then that they're basing it on. And so, you take a look at other markets where there have been ownership changes in the last decade or so, maybe adjust for inflation. And then, of course, you look at the specifics of the Ottawa market as to, you know, what's their fan base, what's their potential for growth. And the big one, of course, in Ottawa is what's the state of the arena?
Not just the state of the current arena, but also the plans for a new downtown arena. How would that factor into any sort of sale, do you think, Professor?
It's kind of like doing a renovation on your home, right? It usually adds value. And so, again, we would look for comparables. And so the Edmonton Oilers, for example, maybe a Canadian market of roughly the same size, a little bit more history, but maybe a good reference point. They added about $250 million Canadian in value to their franchise by just getting a new arena. They didn't even change ownership. It was just the fact that they said, we moved out of the northeast part of Edmonton, which was not exactly the nicest part of town, right into the heart of downtown Edmonton. And next thing you know, their valuation jumps closer to $1 billion Canadian because of that arena. So, you know, if you're in Ottawa and you're looking to buy the team, knowing that you're leaving Kanata and moving into the LeBreton Flats, that's huge value right there. That's the big renovation.
Okay, well, let's kind of stick with this housing comparison. My house might be valued at a certain dollar level, but as we've seen in Canada up until recently with the higher interest rates, when the market was red hot, there can be bidding wars for certain properties, coveted properties. And as you say, the sale of a professional sports franchise is quite rare. How likely is it there could be a bidding war?
So bidding war, if we take that to mean, let's say, more than one bidder, I think it's highly likely that somebody's going to show up and somebody else is going to show up at the same time saying, we want in. I don't know that it's going to turn into one of those TV sitcom situations, you know, where everybody gets out of control and they pay $3 billion for the franchise when it's only worth maybe $750 million. But I think that you're going to see interest come out of some billionaires based down in Toronto, some billionaires maybe based up in Montreal. And the real kicker is, are any billionaires from Houston going to show up and say, we'd like a piece of the action here too, because they maybe have their eyes on relocating the franchise?
And if that was the case, how would you expect the league to respond to something like that?
The league is going to say openly they're committed to Ottawa, and they are. There's no intent here to move the team, but like anything, you know, if an offer comes along that's too great to refuse, it would certainly make the owners sit up and pay attention. Any attempt to relocate the franchise has to be approved by 24 of the 32 owners, and their approval will come with a big fat check in their mailbox. And so, you know, if a group came and said, we want to move it to Quebec City, we want to move it to Houston, it would require a lot of money in relocation fees. And again, that's something that happens very rarely. But when we've seen, for example, like the NFL's Rams move from St. Louis to L.A., or the Chargers move from San Diego up to L.A., or in hockey, it was when the Winnipeg Jets got back their franchise from Atlanta, you know, the relocation fee runs into the millions and millions of dollars. You'd have to have a very deep-pocketed group that was very, very intent on moving it.
Okay. I don't think it'll be 2 years before we speak to you again when it comes to this issue, Professor. Thank you again for the time this morning. Greatly appreciate it.
Good talking to you again, Ron.
Yeah, that's Moshe Lander. He's an economics professor. He does study the economics of professional sports, and he's out of Concordia University. This is Wake Up on City News. It's 7:11.
Hey.
Firm. Fair.
Fun.
Wake Up with Rob Snow returns on City News 101.1.
Member for Davenport, you will be named if you don't stop. Close your fist. Ms. Stiles, your name. You must leave the chamber for the day. The member for Toronto St. Paul's is warned. Ms. Andrew, you are named. You must leave the chamber for the day. Ms. Fife, you are named. You must leave the chamber for the day. Mr. Gates, you are named. You must leave the chamber for the day. Ms. Carpoche, you are named, and you must leave the chamber for the day. Member for Ottawa Center, come forward. If you persist, you will be named.
Okay, so tempers, as you can hear, flaring in the legislature yesterday during the ongoing debate about the Ford government's use of the notwithstanding clause to try and block a planned education workers' strike for tomorrow. You heard Mr. Hardin named yesterday by the Speaker of the House. That is Joel Hardin, one of 18 NDP MPPs ejected from the legislature yesterday. Joel Hardin joins us this morning on City News. Good morning.
Good morning, Rob. How are you?
I'm fine. What had you all worked up yesterday?
Well, you know, we've been talking about this for a while on your programs, Rob. I mean, I'm very upset at how the province is treating custodians, bus drivers, EAs, ECEs, who deserve a right to bargain a good collective agreement. They certainly deserve the kind of raise the premier gave his own MPPs when he gave them 16 grand. Last July. But these are the folks, Rob, I honestly believe that make our schools work. They're there every single day for our kids, and they deserve a fair collective agreement, not a premier that is treating their rights with contempt. So I was upset. It's the second time that's ever happened to me here. The last time is when Premier interfered in the Toronto municipal elections in the summer of 2018. This is important, and every Canadian deserves, you know, a fair collective agreement, good working conditions. And these are the lowest paid workers in the system, an average of $39K a year. So they deserve a raise.
It seems everyone really, in the end, wants the same thing, and that's stability in the education system. The government doesn't want schools to close. The workers say they want to be at work. They don't want the schools to close. I'm sure your party doesn't want to see schools close tomorrow, and yet that Absolutely. Seems right now to be inevitable. So why are we where we are right now, Mr. Hardin?
Well, Rob, the government is hoarding money. That's what I know, that is a verified fact. The people who audit the government's finances, the Financial Accountability Office of Ontario, have said this government has $44 billion, with a B, $44 billion in unaccounted for surplus. That's money they got from the federal government that they have not spent. So I think if I were running this province, Rob, I would be investing in the people that make our public services work. We know about the healthcare staffing crisis, but it's in education too. And I was meeting with custodians, bus drivers, ECs, EAs yesterday in the office. I wasn't kicked out of my own office. They came to talk to me. And they're telling me their members are demoralized. They're upset. And they're looking at a premier who's not bargaining. His team is not bargaining. And there is hope that we can get an agreement today, Rob. But we needed to send a message, not just to the premier, but to those workers, that we are on their side. And I am absolutely on their side.
What do you expect to happen legislatively today? The House is not supposed to sit tomorrow. It's supposed to be off all next week for Remembrance Week. What do you mm-hmm. expect to happen today?
Well, as per the rules that we have, Rob, the House isn't supposed to sit after midnight tonight. And I suspect people I know who are really smart with parliamentary strategy are telling me we can probably expect this government to play a game of brinksmanship right up until that deadline. And I think the fact that they're threatening the notwithstanding clause and taking people's human rights and charter rights to bargain, and if needed, to strike away, tells us about the way this government likes to bargain. So I think we're going to have a game of chicken right up until midnight tonight. But frankly, I just wish the premier would actually back up some of the things I've heard him say about how much he respects the workers of this province. Rob, you've probably seen it. He's had union leaders that have done photo ops with him, like Joe Mancinelli from the laborers, say that he has to back away from this threat to use the notwithstanding clause. So really, he's the leader. The buck stops with him. He has to tell his education minister and the bargaining team that these workers deserve a fair settlement. And I think they deserve at least what the premier gave his own MPPs.
Do you think an agreement is out of the question?
No. No, I've been a union organizer and a union negotiator many times in my life, and I generally see when things are this heated and this polarized and there's an employer determined to try to not budge, things go down to the wire. But 98% of collective agreements, Rob, are negotiated without any labor dispute. It's only in those 2% of cases with a really stubborn employer and sometimes a stubborn union, but in this case, I think a stubborn employer, where things go down to the wire. But they can go down to the wire. My message to the Conservatives on the other side of the aisle is respect the bus drivers. Respect the custodian. They deserve, they're really, Rob, I consider them to be first responders in our education system. They're the ones who frankly deserve a pay increase, not politicians.
Okay. Thank you for the time this morning, Joel Hardin. Great to hear from you, sir.
Same here. Be well. Take care.
Yep. You too. That is Joel Hardin. He was ejected from the legislature today. Be back at it, or yesterday. He'll be back at it today. He's the Ottawa Centre MPP. We'll be right back here on Wake Up. This is City.
He's the opinionated Ottawa icon.
Wake Up with Rob Snow returns on City News 101.1.
The Ontario government's use of the notwithstanding clause as part of this back to work legislation has really become a hot political issue on Parliament Hill, with the Trudeau Liberals, they're really running with this, denouncing Premier Ford's move. The federal New Democrats failed to get the House of Commons to hold an emergency debate on the matter. The Premier and the Prime Minister talked on the phone yesterday about this, and both of their offices released competing versions of the call. with the Prime Minister's office portraying Trudeau as the working class hero, while Premier Ford's people said he's the one standing up for students. During the House of Commons question period, the leader of the opposition, Pierre Poilievre, was trying to nail Trudeau on the $6,000 a night hotel room in London. The Prime Minister, however, wanted to get the Conservative leader to condemn what Doug Ford is doing at Queen's Park. This is a little bit of what it sounded like in the House of Commons yesterday.
The Prime Minister treated himself to a luxurious vacation and a wonderful night of singing in a palatial hotel lobby, one of the swankiest hotels on planet Earth. He then spent $6,000 per night on a single hotel room. Who stayed in that room?
Honorable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, while the Conservatives continue to focus on me, we're going to stay focused on supporting Canadians, whether that's with measures the Conservatives oppose to deliver rental supports for low-income Canadians, or whether that's to make sure that all Canadians can send their kids to the dentist. But we heard the Conservative leader for months talking about freedoms for Canadians, talking about rights and freedoms, and now that a government is preemptively blocking Canadians' fundamental rights and freedoms, not a whisper from this so-called freedom fighter, Mr. Speaker. When is he going to condemn the use of the notwithstanding clause preemptively?
The Honourable Leader of the Opposition.
Nice try. Nice try. He's very clever.
Okay. That's Poilievre and Trudeau. My goodness gracious, it's going to be quite a series of debates between those two over the next few years. Poilievre wouldn't bite on the Ford stuff, but I think he did get Trudeau to finally admit, yeah, it was me. I stayed in the $6,000 a night hotel room. Meantime, Trudeau's Minister of Justice, David Lametti, is promising to do something about the notwithstanding clause and Premier Ford's move here in Ontario, but he refused to reveal yesterday just what sort of action he is contemplating. Coming up after the news, it is the columnists. We have Randall Denley from Post Media and syndicated columnist, former speechwriter for Stephen Harper, Michael Tobe. The 7:30 news is now. Here's Andrew Boyle.
Well, thanks, Rob. Good morning. By the end of the day.
Strong voice, strong opinions.
Wake up with Rob Snow returns on City News 101.1.
Post-media columnist and author Randall Denley is with us. He covers municipal affairs primarily for the Ottawa Citizen, and he writes about the Ford government for the National Post. So no shortage of material to work with this week. Welcome back, Randall Denley.
Morning, Rob.
I understand you will be signing your books again, starting today and running through the weekend. Tell us a little bit more about that, please.
Yeah, see, the fall book signing season is a Christmas show and the Nepean Sportsplex. They haven't had this event since pre-pandemic, but it was always a very good one before. Starts today, runs through Sunday, and I'll be there with all my Chris Redner mysteries.
Awesome. Now, Doug Ford is certainly getting a lot of grief for his decision to use the notwithstanding clause as part of the back-to-work legislation to preempt a strike by these 55,000 education workers represented by CUPE. In your column for the Post today, you argue that he's doing the right thing. Why?
Well, I think he was really left with very few options. I mean, they've been talking, CUPE and the government, since the summer, and probably not getting anywhere. You know, CUPE saying, yeah, we'd like 11.7% raise every year for 3 years. Oh, and benefit improvements. Yeah, we want those too. It's not what you would call a realistic position, but really the fight we're in now was started by the union when they said, well, that's it. We're going on strike Friday unless there's a deal. So the government said, okay, we're in a legislature. But it was the union that got the tennis match going, and I think, you know, they're really undermining themselves now by saying, yeah, we're striking Friday. We don't care if the strike's illegal, and we're going to stay out indefinitely until there's a negotiated settlement. You know, it's difficult now, I think, for CUPE to say, oh, all we want is, you know, fair bargaining at the table. they're the ones putting the pressure on, the government's responding to it, and I think that point's a little bit lost. It's not a case of the Ford government saying, yeah, let's use the notwithstanding clause, let's just choose out of the blue to bring the hammer down on these people, even though, you know, things are going well at the table, we're going back and forth, and the government has said this week, look, you know, if you've got, apparently Ian's got an offer to bring, something less. So bring the offer, we'll be happy to talk about it, but don't strike on Friday. And the response is, oh yeah, we're striking on Friday and we're striking every day. So I don't think it's very easy to defend the union at this point. I feel a bit sorry for them because I think they've been very poorly represented by their leadership, though.
Why do you think the union has overplayed its hand, Randall Denly?
I'm going to go back to poor leadership again, but, you know, negotiation isn't really starting out with a number that most people will go, what? How high? I mean, who gets a 33% raise in any contract anytime? Okay, maybe a superstar hockey player. But in the real world, who would ever get that kind of raise? So it's a silly ask to begin with. But then to go through months of negotiation and never move off it. Nope, that's our number. We got to have it. Normally in a union and management negotiation, you know, management won't come in low, union come in high, and they both know in their own minds that, yeah, we'll end up in the middle somewhere. And they both like to end up on, you know, their side of the middle, like a little higher or a little lower than the middle. This is a bit of an odd one, though, because the government's offer was quite low. And it was, you know, in my opinion, unrealistically low. But I did feel that the union could get more through negotiation, and they probably still can now if they would go to the table, because it's not a pretty thing for the government to use a notwithstanding clause to settle this labor dispute. It's never been done before, and they are getting a lot of heat for it, and it's something they could do without. So I'm sure they would much prefer to make a deal with the union, but at this point, the union is not prepared to do anything except strike. And they just seem to have forgotten about the parents and the kids in this whole equation. I think they're going to get public sympathy with an illegal strike. I don't think so. And to me, Ford's choice was a pretty simple one. I'm either going to back parents and students, or I'm going to bow to the union. Oh, yeah, strike. Gee, we better give you what you want. Well, he chose parents and kids, and I think that was the right choice.
Yeah. Watching and reading some of the news coverage would leave you with the impression that the workers themselves have a lot of public sympathy. Is that your read of it, Randall Denly, when it comes to the battle for support here? Who has the better read of public opinion right now?
QP, if they play their cards better, because, you know, as I say, their average salary and this group of workers is just under $40,000. Now, that's a bit deceptive because it includes some part-time people, but they're not highly paid. So they have that going in. We're not highly paid, and we're in a time of very high inflation. So we'd expect more than, you know, 1 or 2% increase. I think most people say, yeah, like, you know, something 3 or 4 maybe, or more in the first year and then lower something. But when you just say, no, 11.7, if it was 11.7 for a 3-year contract, then, well, okay, that's, you know, not, doesn't sound crazy. But it's for 1 year and then another year and then another year. I think you lose sympathy there because the people who are ultimately paying this think, well, I'm not getting a 33% raise. Why should you? And when now this week they say to people, look, our quest for a 33% raise is more important than your kids being in school. So we're just going to shut schools down. It's extremely disruptive for parents. And, you know, the background of this obviously is the last 2 years of COVID. Kids have been out of school in Ontario for a ridiculous length of time, and they're behind. They need to be in school. And I think that's part of how QP misread this, too. You know, Stephen Lecce, the education minister, has been saying for months, schools are staying open. The schools will not close under any circumstances. And somehow they thought, yeah, but that doesn't apply to QP. You know, like, we can close the schools, right? And I think this action, this legislation this week says, no, we meant that the schools will stay open, and we're going to do whatever it takes to keep them open. And I think it would be a rare parent who would say, you know, my support for the 33% raise is so strong that I don't mind having to scramble for child care and have my kid out of class and all that kind of stuff. I'm prepared to make that sacrifice. I doubt you will find many people doing that.
Hey, thank you for your time this morning, Randall Denley. All the best. Hope you sell lots of books over the next few days.
I appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks again. Citing the latest in his series, the Chris Redner series, such a great series of books from Randall Denley. He'll be doing at the Nepean Sportsplex today and all through the weekend. I know he'd love to see you and sign your copy. Coming up, Michael Taube, syndicated columnist, my friend on the right side of things. We'll talk more about the federal angle to the notwithstanding clause and all of these disappointed liberals when we come back on Wake Up with City News.
He's a pillar of community opinion.
Wake Up with Rob Snow returns on City News 101.1.
He's my friend on the right side of things, syndicated columnist, former speechwriter for Stephen Harper. Michael Taube is back with us on Wake Up here on City News. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Bob. How are you?
I'm really fine, Michael. I'd really like to get your take on this whole notwithstanding clause controversy, but with a kind of a different angle. I want to know what you think about all the liberal outrage in Ottawa, because I can't help but ask myself, where was all of this upset when Quebec was passing legislation like Bill 21 and Bill 96? What do you think about the outrage in liberal Ottawa?
I think that's actually a very good comparison. Yes, I mean, to be fair, there were some liberals who were agitated by it when it was being done that at that time when it was related to Quebec. But you're right, we're seeing a lot more of it now. And again, it's not surprising. It relates to a conservative premier who has become extremely successful in politics, at least in Ontario, and it's made life very difficult for the Liberals, to the point now that the Liberal Party is still in the Ontario legislature, not an official party due to its number of seats. They have been trumped, and I don't mean Donald Trump, but trumped very badly by a politician that they thought very little of, they thought would be unsuccessful in many different ways, and he has proved to be, that being Doug Ford, the premier, extremely successful. In terms of the notwithstanding clause, look, I don't know what exactly you've mentioned before on your show, so I can't speak for you, but I'm not crazy about the use of the notwithstanding clause. I would have preferred that there had been another way to do it. We found in history that the notwithstanding clause has obviously caused enormous points of controversy. It's been an area of frustration. When Doug Ford used it in 2018 to lower the number of seats in Toronto City Hall, which I live in Toronto, from 47 to 25, people got loony for that, which is understandable. You would hope that the notwithstanding clause, which is one of the most imperfect tools in a politician's toolbox, was used as little as infrequently as possible. But I think in this case, based on the way that CUPE, the union, has handled things, and based on the fact that they were still threatening to go on strike this Friday, irrespective of the fact that we've been through COVID for a couple of years, our kids have definitely suffered education-wise in terms of the education they've received and the education they've been able to get in person, which is what was the most desirable thing for Ontario parents and Ontario families to have. Unfortunately, while I would have preferred Doug Ford had used another mechanism, and I think most people would have preferred it too, I think the premier himself would have preferred something different. QP basically just left it to a position where there was nothing else he could do, and I, regrettably, Ford had to use the notwithstanding clause. But I hope, once again, it's one of the very rare examples where he ever has to.
Okay. Michael Taube is with us, a syndicated columnist. His most recent Troy Media column is nice read about your CFL experience. You hadn't been to a CFL game in a long time. I believe you went to see the Alouettes and Argonauts, and you really enjoyed yourself. What made it so enjoyable?
I did. It's actually the first game I've seen live from the CFL in close to 30 years, and part of the reason for that, not to get too long-winded, is I've written about it in the past, I talked about it in the past. I sort of came off of the CFL, which means I wasn't following it at all for many years, so that sort of explains the long sojourn where I wasn't actually going to the stadium. But again, I just became turned off by Canadian football, and whenever I tried to compare the CFL to the NFL, you know, our American, the American version of the football game, which I fully admit to this day I obviously prefer. I'm a Dallas Cowboys fan, and I have to admit it. It became very difficult for me to sort of figure something out that way and then to sort of compare the two. So what I eventually did was I just found a way to look at the CFL as a separate entity from the NFL, and it worked quite nicely. The game itself was really good. 38-33, the Owls beat the Argos. It was a really good game. High scoring, lots of great plays, some great touchdown passes. The two starting quarterbacks actually sat out the game. But what was, you know, and because basically the Owls and the Argos had already had their playoff positions defined. But I think what really stood out for me were just looking at all the excitement from the fans. The CFL fan by nature, and I'm sure most CFLers or people who follow it know this, the CFL fans are very passionate about their sport. They're passionate about Canadian football. And unlike American fans, who I greatly like and admire, and I like the country very much, that being the United States, Canadian fans can be a little competitive, so you can see a little bit of tiny bit of jousting between the Argos fans and the Montreal Alouettes fans. But in the end, it's all good-natured fun, which I think in many ways, Rob, is what makes us Canadian, is that we can be competitive, but at the same time, we're not going to take it too wildly seriously where we're going to get into fistfights and brawls over things. Not that it happens all the time in the NFL, it doesn't, but you just can see that there's a different atmosphere in the CFL, and all things considered, from the concession stand, the fans, the excitement, the great weather we had that day, it was just a great experience overall.
Glad to hear it. Glad to hear it. I'm glad you had a good time, and I'm glad you could share that story with us this morning, Mike. Thanks. We'll speak soon.
My pleasure. Take care, Rob.
Yeah, bye-bye. Syndicated columnist Michael Tobin. How about value for money? You saw the Allison Argos in Toronto. $28. $28. Where else can you get a ticket? $28 to see CFL in Toronto. Okay, Dave's faves on the way. David Smith and his lighthearted look at the news. This is
Firm, Fair,
Fun.
Wake Up with Rob Snow returns on City News 101.1.
All right, time for Dave's faves. David Smith, host of the Talk Back Hour.
Hello.
With his lighthearted look at the news. Remember, we do have to get the news on time. So what have you got for us today?
Well, Rob, today I have for you an update on one of what I think is Canada's biggest, one of the biggest unsolved political mysteries in our country. So this is a story that first surfaced over 5 years ago, and it rocked the national news media here in Canada at the time. It shook the electorate to its core. All right, I'm being a bit dramatic, but do you remember this story about Matthew Perry, the actor who played Chandler on Friends? He once beat up Justin Trudeau when they were both children. Oh. Do you remember this?
I didn't know that.
You didn't know that? Okay, yeah, so let's refresh some memories here. So this is Matthew Perry, the actor who played Chandler on Friends, on Jimmy Kimmel way back in 2017. And this is quite the tale. So this will refresh your memory from 5 years ago.
The Prime Minister, the current Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, somebody you went to school with.
I did. I was a couple years ahead of him.
Okay. How old were you at this time?
Fifth grade. So whatever age you are in fifth grade.
Okay. And do you remember? 10, probably. Do 10? You remember him around school?
I do. I have a story about him that I'm not proud of.
What? Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah.
I was reminded of this. My friend Chris Murray, who was also in the fifth grade in Canada, reminded me that we actually beat up Justin Trudeau.
You beat him up?
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. So Matthew Perry and Justin Trudeau actually attended the same school for a little while. That's true. And so that was on Kimmel at the time. But now Matthew Perry's doing a media tour promoting a new book. He's written a new memoir, and he was on Stephen Colbert earlier this week with a shocking revelation.
You grew up in Canada, in Ottawa, went to school with a young man named Justin Trudeau.
Yes.
Now, who gets recognized more in Canada, you or Trudeau?
I would say Trudeau. But, you know, there was a big rumor about us.
What?
That I beat him up in grade school.
Did you?
I don't think so. No.
What?
But you're not entirely sure.
No. My friends, Brian Murray and Chris Murray, who were the guys and myself who invented that weird way of talking. You know, could it be colder in here?
Sure.
Could it be colder in here, by the way?
Yes.
It's really cold.
It could not.
Okay.
No.
So they told me that we beat up Justin Trudeau, and I just believed them.
Oh, my goodness. The whole thing is the product of a false memory. In that clip,
it's fake news.
Harry admits his friend told him the story years later, and he just believed him. I just feel bad for the printing companies who have to recall all those history textbooks from 2017. You got to take that out of the record now.
Yeah, and, you know, knowing what poor Matthew Perry has been through, and, you know, you just look at the poor guy. I don't think he would not want to climb into the boxing ring with Justin Trudeau.
No, I don't think so.
No, no. Okay. All right, Dave will be in hosting the Talk Back Hour, of course, in an hour from now. The 8 o'clock news is next on City.